program comes from WORT's listener sponsors and Isthmus Newspaper. Government, the arts, and all things Madison at isthmus.com. Support for this program comes from WORT's listener sponsors and Isthmus Newspaper. Isthmus is back on newsstands the first Thursday of every month, and now a nonprofit. Isthmus continues to expand its independent coverage of local government, the arts, and all things Madison at isthmus.com.
Underway in New York, where he's facing charges of making hush money payments to porn star Stormy Daniels. Neda Tawfiq is following the day's events.
Even before his day in court begins, he was out on the campaign trail here in New York. His campaign saying because he's stuck here in court for several hours a day, 4 days a week, they are bringing the campaign trail to them. So he met with construction workers, union workers, and we heard him kind of repeat some of his talking points, beginning now to nickname this trial the Biden trial, even though it is a state case with no connection to the Department of Justice. This is the kind of campaign rhetoric we're going to hear again and again, because Donald Trump is certainly taking advantage of the media spotlight around this unprecedented trial.
The French President Emmanuel Macron has warned that the European Union faces immense risks over the coming decade at a time of upheavals around the world. He said modern Europe was mortal and could die, urging it to ensure its own security. Mr. Macron praised steps towards greater unity across the bloc in some fields, including on issues such as finance and health. But he said Europe's rearmament was too slow.
The principal danger for European security is obviously the war in Ukraine. Our security is dependent on Russia not winning this war of aggression that it is waging. This is essential. That's why we were right since the start of the war to sanction Russia, to help the Ukrainians, and to continue to do so. We're fortunate to have the Americans on our side for this and to be constantly increasing our help and support.
Human Rights Watch says more than 220 civilians were killed in a single day this year by the army in Burkina Faso. The organisation said the massacre happened in two villages on the 25th of February. More than 50 children are reported to be among the dead. Richard Hamilton has more details about the attack.
Eyewitnesses told the rights organisation that a military convoy of more than 100 soldiers descended on the first village about half an hour after jihadists had been in the area. The soldiers went door to door, pulling residents out of their homes, rounding them up and opening fire on them. They then did the same in the next village about 5 kilometres away. And in both places, the soldiers also shot at those who attempted to flee.
World News from the BBC.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2027. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 30th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 30th. More information and board applications are available at WORTFM.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
Literacy Network invites you to help them celebrate 50 years and toast to the next half century and free adult literacy education. From 7 to 9 p.m. on Thursday, April 25th at Boardman Clark, you can enjoy signature cocktails, hors d'oeuvres, and a program that features speeches from Lupita Montoto of La Movida and other supporters. All proceeds benefit Literacy Network students working toward their dreams and goals, including becoming U.S. citizens, securing job opportunities, and more. Registration information for this event is available at literacynetwork.org/50th celebration. Deadline to register is Sunday, April 21st. In addition to the event, you can also check out the silent auction, which is live now through April 25th. That's a toast to 50 years of Literacy Network at Boardman Clark, 1 South Pinckney, from 7 to 9 p.m. on Thursday, April 25th. You are listening to WORT Madison.
Support for this program is provided by WORT's listener sponsors and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 2304. Local 2304 is a small local union with a big agenda, bringing power to the people by representing the workers who provide safe and reliable gas and electric service at MG&E, the professional union reps at Madison Teachers Incorporated, the field organizers and canvassers at For Our Future, and the staff collective right here at WORT. More information about the union is available on their website at ibew2304.com.
Good morning, and it's 8:07, and you are tuned into WORT 89.9 FM. My name's Tony Cust. On the other end, it's time for the Thursday, April 25th edition of the 8 o'clock Buzz. And just to make sure that all of my theme musics are working, I'm playing one on the carts. Listen to it. And I'm playing the other one on the real CD player. See how that works? They both work, Eli. Eli, it's working.
Is it?
Yeah.
I don't need to sing it?
I can't hear you, though.
Why not?
I don't know. Well, talk louder.
I'm on mic three, man. Come on.
I got you, man.
Okay. We've got guests today in studio. That's why I'm on mic three.
All right, good. And that's cool. Let me play both of these theme songs at the same time. And they're not in sync, everybody, so... Yeah.
In the round.
Good morning, everyone. And this is WRT 89.9 FM in Madison, Wisconsin. It's time for the Thursday 8 o'clock Buzz. We do have some guests today. As a matter of fact, we're going to be speaking with Greg Willard to start off today's show. He's got an art show, Paper Play, Art in COVID. It's at the Arts and Literature Laboratory. And we're going to talk a little bit about that with Greg Willard, who also is he's a board programmer. He does a late Friday show. He started the Thursday 8 o'clock Buzz. He's the one who started it.
So I there's people before you doing this, Tony? I didn't know that.
No, there isn't, but yeah. We'll just say he started it. He was our first news person.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so back in the day when we had our own news department, we would have news read by an actual person during the show.
Like Walter Cronkite.
Yes, yes, but better.
Are you telling me we don't read the news anymore on this
No,
show?
We don't. But by the way, I got your newspaper.
I said I can read the news if you need to read the news.
Let me get it. Sorry.
Let's see, anything
there
happened
today? Read anything in there? No bananas today because there were no ripe bananas?
What the heck?
What do you think about a plantain? There was some... ripe plantains at the co-op this morning.
Okay, I'll say I've never eaten a plantain that's not fried. I've only ever eaten fried plantains.
They don't taste good raw.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
They don't taste good fried, actually. Oh. They don't taste good anyway,
oh,
if you ask
me. They can be good if you get them fried. They taste a little sweet.
Really?
A little yogurt.
All right, anyhow, so we'll be speaking with Greg. And then later on in the show, we're going to be speaking, get our We have not been talking that much about Gaza on the Buzz, and every month at least we do one segment. We'll be speaking again with Jennifer Lowenstein about current events in Gaza, but we'll also be speaking with Paul DiRienzo, who's a freelance journalist, a former news reporter for WBAI in New York, who has spent the last couple of days at Columbia University. So he's going to give us a little report on what's been happening there. And then, most importantly, we're going to be speaking with Jim Wills, who is Eli's dad.
That is correct.
And he just rode his bike cross country.
Yeah.
And it was a fundraiser. And we're going to find out what that was all about. And Eli, are you going to interview him or am I going to? I was thinking I was.
Think it'd be fun to have you interview him. I can chime in with some questions. I already talked to him. I already know the story.
You got some excellent questions. Well, yeah. I want to know the story. But the best part of the story is he rode his bike across country in 1 week. Right?
It was 45 days.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, it was. I thought that was pretty amazing.
Yeah, 1 week. You start doing the math on that. That's pretty crazy.
All right. Okay, well, in a minute. Greg Willard and everybody, thanks for tuning in. And
the views and opinions expressed on the Thursday 8 o'clock Buzz do not necessarily represent the opinions of the Warp paid staff, its board of directors, or our millions of volunteers. The Thursday 8 o'clock Buzz is for entertainment purposes only.
1, 2, 3.
So there.
All right.
Let's stay tuned,
everybody. Got some music for y'all.
13, and you are tuned into WORT 89.9 FM in Madison, Wisconsin.
Joining me in the studio, I'm very pleased to have an artist, programmer here, writer. I don't know what else to say about you, Greg, other than you're a really cool guy, man.
You're a cool guy, too.
Very cool guy. Greg Willard.
Thank you for having me, Tony.
Thanks for being here this morning. Greg has a exhibition of artwork that he's done. It's Paper Play, Art in COVID. And Paper Play, Art in COVID comprises a group of small frame drawings made between 2020 and early 2023. The drawings use symbolic or expressionist strategies to respond to the felt experience of the pandemic, abjuring spectacle or abstraction. Is that a true description of your artwork and what you're doing here, Greg?
That's pretty good.
All right. Well, let's talk about the pandemic. And what's the difference between doing art during the pandemic and after or before the pandemic?
I was really afraid you were going to ask me that because I don't have a good answer to it at all.
I'm just I'm just here to make you afraid.
Yeah, you make me very afraid. Yeah, it's clearly a kind of a framing device. I'm not sure a good answer to that. I do know that I'm not sure if it was a response to the pandemic exactly, but around that time my work got a lot more pared down and simplified. I got sort of impatient with more complicated media like painting, and started to do very, very direct, fast drawings with using a pencil and paper.
Mm-hmm. What about the subject matter? Was that different also, or what?
Yeah, that's a good question, Tony. Jeez.
Thank you. I'm full of them, Greg. You remember?
Yeah. The subject matter, there wasn't any, really. I started working not only simplifying media, but what was going on internally, just very immediate, very spontaneous, unconscious kind of stuff. Working with scribbles and scratching and scumbling and erasures over a long, long period of time, and then slowly, usually slowly, images would sort of come out, and I'd kind of tweak them and amplify some things and block out other things. You know, kind of working very unconsciously and intuitively.
What was going on internally within yourself? I mean, all of us approached the pandemic differently. I think a lot of us thought it was going to be the end of the world.
We all were going to die initially. One thing that was going on was I started to kind of imagine a more public or social kind of response to the pandemic in terms of a storytelling circle that I imagined starting or initiating in a local park, like a small pocket park that's near my house. It's actually right across the street from the Catholic Multicultural Center. And I would go walk by there, and it was usually all deserted. And I would think, what would it be like if I tried to invite a storytelling circle using pictures? And I'd been reading about this tradition of story boxes in Japan. A lot of countries have it, where, you know, a person, usually like an amateur storyteller in a public space, will set up a box with a picture and start telling stories about it, for a lot of times for children, but other people on the street. And I started writing some stories that imagined that. I never had the nerve to actually do it, but I sat there a few times drawing and thinking about this, and did a whole series of stories about this also, which I have a little bit of here for you, Tony.
Excellent.
There you go.
Now, is this part of your exhibit, or
I've got sample drawings and pictures and stories in packets that are available there, so you can pick them up. The entire manuscript is sort of like a novella, so I'm trying to publish that outside other venues. But you can pick up smaller versions of it at the show.
Mm-hmm. Some people don't know this about you, but I do, is that you're also English as a second language teacher, and you've been for a very, very long time. And I've been following your work that you've been posting on social media. And you use the same process for teaching people. You draw stories. You depict something happening. It might be mundane. Somebody goes to the store and buys an apple or something. But you draw the pictures, and then you have your students who are trying to learn English write it, right? Or in English, or say in English what's going on. How's that worked out? And is this kind of the same concept in terms of this picture box?
Kind of, yeah. It's sort of related. I've always used like quick sketches and pictures in classroom situations, but it got more, like you were describing, more formalized in the past year or so, and I started posting it online too because I thought people would enjoy it.
Well, I thought it appeared to me that it was effective. Is this a very effective way of helping people understand the language?
Yeah, I think so. I use stories a lot. I mean, it just seems like a no-brainer to try to introduce narrative into language learning, and working off of drawings, I think is just, for me, it's like really fun, and I think the students like it.
Can we talk about your paper play, Art and COVID, exhibition at Arts and Literature Lab? When can people go see that, and how do they find it? It's on the third floor there, I understand.
Yeah, it's a very great space if you haven't been there. It's mm-hmm. right beside the Sylvie on South Livingston, 111 South Livingston.
Right, on East Main in Livingston, there, uh-huh. right across the street from the Sylvie.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not owned by Frank Productions.
No.
Live Nation.
They have the parking space is available there for Art and Lit Lab. You have to pay it, but it's not bad if it's not during an event. Lots of street parking also.
When can people go? When is it?
It's open Monday to Friday from 10 to 5 and Saturday from 12 to 5. And it's on the third floor. There are three different floors of Art and Literature Lab that all have exhibition spaces. And the third floor is called the Projects floor, where individual art studios are located and also classrooms and workshops, and then a stretch of wall space where I'm exhibiting some works. And some other artists also up there.
Mm-hmm. So many of us are struggling, this is from your handout here, many of us are struggling with the aftermath of the COVID emergency. Your drawings, these drawings, like my experience of the time, seem too fast or too slow or too small or too slant for message, analysis, reportage, or spectacle. They present instead a miniature theater that haunts a paper stage, resistant to closure or cliche. I mean, is there a general theme? Is it a movie? Are the pieces just to be taken in individually?
Both.
Okay.
It's not a movie.
That's a good answer.
It's definitely not a movie. It's not a single narrative at all. But there's a totality to it that I think you can experience when you see the work. But yeah, the pieces are not, you know, like episodes of a cartoon or cells of a animation or anything like that. They're individual drawings, but I think they cohere into one big thing that holds the wall.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I'm speaking with Greg Willard, and not only is he an artist, but he's a programmer here at WRT and a volunteer, and he's the host of Fiction Jones, which can be heard on which Friday nights?
Third, fourth, and fifth Friday from 11 to 12 midnight.
All right. And what about that? You had your ongoing and continual novel that you were reading for a long time. Did you ever finish that?
Yeah, I finished
you
it.
You really?
and sent it out.
I wasn't listening that
a million
Friday
publishers.
Night.
That particular book, it never got published, and the second and third and one didn't get published either.
Well, hey, man, there's still time.
There's still time. Yeah, I'm always sending things out. I've published a lot of shorter works and excerpts from novels, mm-hmm. but not a single novel.
Right.
No.
All right.
But that was kind of like the beginning of Fiction Jones. Now it's over the past, you know, 12, 14 years, it's been reading other books.
Classics. I mean, yeah. If you're driving around on Friday night, late at night, at, what's it, 11 o'clock or so, you might,
yeah.
The Brothers Dostoevsky. Or
oh, that's right. It. That's right.
And I'm
read
like, whoa.
The Brothers Karamazov nice. Over 2 years, yes. Largely over the pandemic. And now we're... almost finished with Frankenstein.
So, Eli, you got to tune in on some Friday nights.
It seems like
Fiction Jones.
It seems like I would get a good literature education.
You sure would, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Greg, I want to thank you for coming down this morning, spending this time with us. It's like old times in a way.
Yeah, thanks, Tony. Yeah.
Totally unprepared and having problems with the board. Charlie thinks I should get an engineer.
I used the other board last time, but this one, I mean, it's still pretty sturdy.
This is the old board from that room. So there's a new board in.
There's a new board in.
Do you use that?
All right. Yeah.
Does it work?
Oh yeah, it's great.
I'm afraid to touch it because it's gonna break. Right. Okay, Greg Willard, go see his work. Paper Play. It's Art in COVID. It's at the Arts and Literature Lab, right at Main and Livingston Street. And again, the hours are
Tuesday to Friday, 10 to 5, and Saturday from 12 to 5.
All right, good. Greg, thank you very much.
And thank you.
And thank you for everything you do for WORT, man, and the community, too.
Thank you.
All right. In a minute, we're going to talk to Eli's dad.
Just for fun.
Yeah. Jesus.
Mamacita me decía, no corres en la 16. Cuando yo fui un niño, di zapatos en mis pies. Mi mamacita me decía, no corras en la 16. Mi mamá me decía, mi papá me decía, no corres por la 16. En la madrugada, sirviendo mi leche de arroz. Hasta ahora que estoy crecido, todavía oigo su voz. Los pajarillos cantaban la canción de Susana. Cuando el sol se subía, tempranito en la mañana.
A29, you are tuned into WORT. Joining me on the line, I'm very, very pleased to have Jim Wills, who is the father of Eli. Wills, say hi to your dad, Eli.
Good morning, Dad. Good to get you on the
phone. Hey, good morning.
Jim, thank you so much. Very nice to meet you here. And I guess we've been kind of following your trails, and I mean your trip. Riding your bike across the country. I guess I've been corrected. You did not do it in a week.
No, I did not do it in a week. No.
Okay.
That's the lie I've been telling.
You're right. I was like, yeah, wow, man, a week.
There are people that do it in a week called the Race Across America. So they do it in 6 days, but not me. So.
Well, that's nuts. Let's talk about it. First of all, you What inspired you to do this? You've ridden a bike before, right?
Yeah, I've ridden the bike before, yeah. Okay. First of all, Tony, it's just an honor to be on The Buzz, and thanks for having me on with Eli. This is quite an honor. I'm really proud of that, so it's really good. And real quick, following up on an earlier story, I did have plantains with a Cuban sandwich just yesterday for lunch down here in Tampa where I'm recuperating, and they were very good.
I'm sorry I was disparaging plantains. That's all they had at the co-op. Next time I'll pick some up, and we'll fry them down here. All right. Okay. We got that out of the way. First of all, now you did this with a group of people, and this was also a fundraiser. Can you talk a little bit about who you went with and what you guys were raising money for?
Yeah, real quick. I was with a group called Cycle of Life Adventures. There were 10 bicyclists, and we did have a van, a mechanic, and a driver following us. So we were out bicycling every day while they carried everything. And we were all riding for different causes. But I was riding for a cause called Move Beyond Surviving, which is an organization that gets breast cancer patients after their treatment, gets them outdoors as part of their healing process. And just a real quick background on that, I was supposed to do this ride in 2023 at the age of 60, and I was training to do it at that time. And unfortunately, my wife came down with breast cancer. Wow. The good news is she's doing great. But I had to delay my trip a year, and getting to know the process that she went through, which was much more of a journey than my journey, and part of her healing process was getting out and hiking. I hooked up with this organization to raise money so that they could get more breast cancer patients outdoors after surgery and as part of the healing process. So it just kind of connected with my outdoor trip. And just a great small organization to work for, the support.
Well, did you consider yourself a serious biker? I mean, is this something you do all the time, go for long rides, and is this a new experience for you?
Well, no, so just a real quick background. You asked my inspiration. So this goes back to when I was in middle school, and a funny story, the school district I was in canceled bus service, and my dad took me to a bike store and said, "Hey, you're going to ride a bike to school now."
I thought that was a good excuse to not go to school.
But a short story after that is, I think the Christmas of that year, my mother bought me a book called Pedaling to the Ends of the Earth, and it had a great subtitle of, you know, four young men come of age in a great bicycling adventure. And that book always inspired me, and I said, someday I want to do a great bicycle adventure. And, this was kind of what inspired the trip personally. I kind of transitioned out of some work about 4 years ago and took up biking kind of more heavily to get prepared for a trip like this. Mm-hmm. So that's how it all came together. So,
I mean, I'm just thinking about just the whole mechanics of it. I mean, you guys started in San Diego, right?
Yeah, we started in San Diego.
Right. Well, that's nice. The weather's fine there. But I've been biking across the country. I mean, what roads do you take, and how far do you go every day?
Yeah. So just real quick. We started in San Diego, California, and there is a southern bicycle route across the U.S. that is done by a national bicycle group. But so we average about 70 miles a day, and it's along this route, but, you know, I would describe our route as being very very typical of what you'd expect. You know, in California, for an example, we had a ride on I-10, on the berm of I-10 for about 40 miles. But most of the roads are more rural roads where you really get to see, how the country lives in rural areas. So, you know, they try to keep you off the traffic routes, but unfortunately you can't avoid them all.
What about the people you run into? Are they happy to see you? Do they like what you guys are doing? I mean, it's another cross-country biking group or whatever?
Yeah, so everyone we met was extremely nice. And just kind of keep in perspective, our guide told us that probably, you know, the time you do this route is March and April, and there's probably less than 100 people doing this currently at this time frame. And so, you know, we're one of 100. But everyone is very excited for you. And, you know, some of them just can't grasp doing it. Others know that you're doing it and cheer you on. Mm-hmm. Probably one of the most exciting parts is through Arizona and the like, we bike a lot along the railroads carrying all the container ships out of, carrying all the containers out of California. And every train that comes by honks your horn. They know what you're doing. And, you know, motorcycle groups come by and all cheer you on. So probably the greatest part was everywhere we went, the people were behind us.
That's great.
And knew we were doing something special.
That's great. Were there any mishaps? Anybody get hurt doing this? We got to talk about that.
So we only had two minor mishaps. One in El Paso, Texas. A gentleman was got his tire stuck in a streetcar rail and fell over. And coming off a bridge in Texas, unfortunately, two of our bicyclists collided and were just injured minorly. Oh. The good news is you do a trip with 10 people, and we had a physician and a nurse on the trip. So we were all taken care of in those realms.
What about
my worst injury was I got three bees underneath my glove one day, and they stung my hand. So.
That sounds pretty bad, though. That could be bad, potentially.
Yeah.
What about the people you went with? Did you know them beforehand, or you guys all just meet
online? No, didn't know any of them beforehand. Just all kind of had this similar venture. An interesting story following up on something you said. You know, you said, did you bicycle before? There was actually a gentleman on the trip who had never bicycled before November and had just retired in November and had only biked for 2 months before this trip.
What? And he made it?
Yeah.
He
made it.
Wow.
Yeah, he had a little bit of a sore rear end, but...
Jeez, at least.
But he made it across the U.S. in doing that. So, and just all very interesting, dynamic people. We had a couple who both worked for Peace Corps and State Department who had biked around the world and decided they wanted to bike on a tandem across the country. You know, that's quite a trip on a tandem.
So they did that. Wow. That's pretty amazing.
And you talk about mishaps. One of the most interesting things that you have to deal with on this trip, though, is flat tires. I think the tandem couple had over 20 flat tires.
What?
You know?
Is that, I don't want to ask why, or probably something about the tandem bikes themselves. So, Eli said you guys spent a lot of time in Texas. Why?
Well, you know,
it's a big state.
So think about this. This is something to put in perspective. You bike across the southern United States, and you spend over a third of your time across the state of Texas.
Damn.
So, you know, you hear everything's bigger in Texas, and that's including the geography of it. So, quite a bit of time in Texas, and, it was really interesting. The West... many people thought you would get tired of Texas, but, you know, West Texas into Austin was very beautiful. And coming into Austin, you go through Texas Hill Country. And one of the really neat things we got to see was, Lady Bird Johnson planted wildflowers along all the roads down there in the early 70s. And all the bluebonnets are blooming, just miles and miles of bluebonnets. So some of the most beautiful roads that we had all through the country. Just made for quite a trip.
All right.
Sounds
like it. We're speaking with Jim Wills, Eli Wills, my producer's dad, who just biked across the country. Did not do it in a week, like as was earlier reported in the news, officially
the
reported.
The 8 o'clock buzz is for entertainment purposes.
Purposes only, right. The disclaimer there. Texas, big and... Well, big and stupid place. No, it's not stupid. It's a beautiful place, I'm sure. What next now? Anything? Are you planning any other big bike trips or what?
You know, I haven't 100% have what next, but I'm looking at, one of the things that I did training for this was I trained in northern Wisconsin up in the North Woods around Rhinelander and in that area. Yeah, and up in Boulder Junction, and that's a beautiful area up there.
Yes.
But and it was a great place to train. And but one of the things that's getting real popular now with biking is gravel bicycling, where you ride on gravel roads and stay out of, some of the traffic. And gravel biking is really taking off, and I'm looking at two trips in gravel biking, one in West Virginia, and if I do all right on that, there's a nice gravel bike trip across Scotland. So thinking about taking that on as a next adventure, maybe.
Wow. I did see something about gravel biking. I was kind of like, wow, you're going to wipe out and hurt yourself. I'm always thinking about, you know, accidents or whatever.
Yeah. Tony's just hurting himself.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Jim, well, first of all, thank you very much for being on the show. Very nice to kind of meet you over the airwaves here. And, well, you know, I think there's a gravel road that comes right up to Madison, Wisconsin from wherever you're at.
We'll be on it, man. We'll be on it. So, hey, I appreciate the time and, appreciate you taking care of Eli on Thursday mornings.
Sorry, he's doing all right. What do you think about? How's he doing? Let's talk. Let's embarrass him.
You know, I'm really proud of my son. You know, his radio work started in elementary school when he did the news. He did the news for an elementary school on video. So, you know, you could have him do the news for there. But, no, I enjoy listening to him and I enjoy what he's doing up in Madison. And, you know, I'm a bicyclist. I love Madison. That's when I get up to see him. It's a great vacation for me. So,
all right. Well, next time you're here, I hope to see you. Maybe you can stop by the Carnival Bar and check out his halftime show there.
Yeah, we'll do that, all right? And thanks again for having me on.
No problem. Thank you very much. Jim Wills, everybody. And you may see him in person sometime in Madison riding his bike. Thanks a lot, Jim.
All right. Thank you, Tony.
You were awfully shy. You didn't say much, Eli.
I told you, Tony, I already know the story. I was waiting on you to chime in. I think you got it. I think you covered it pretty well.
All right, cool. It sounds like a very cool trip. Your dad seems like a very nice man.
Yeah, good guy. Good to get the plantains down in Florida.
That's right. All right. In 1 minute, we're going to speak with Paul DiRienzo, give us a report from what's going on at Columbia, and also Jennifer Lowenstein. So at the same time, we're going to try this, everybody. Say 43, you are tuned into WORT 89.9 FM in Madison, your listener-sponsored community radio station. Well, it's been over 200 days since the Gaza War, was started on October 7th. Many people will argue about the start date for the struggle for the people of Palestine, but things are heating up on college campuses everywhere, and it's kind of pioneered and starting at Columbia University here in, joining me on the line, first of all, I'm very pleased to have Jennifer Lowenstein, who's with Madison Rafa Sister City Project, Middle East lecturer at Penn State University and University of Wisconsin, and and also Paul DiRienzo, who's a former WBAI reporter, who has spent the last couple of days with the students at Columbia. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, and I still am a WBA reporter, have been since October, again. Oh. I'm back and forth with it. It's like a yo-yo.
I know, so that's good. Sorry about that.
A yo-yo over there. It's a yo-yo.
And good morning, Jennifer, and thank you for being up.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
All right, well, Paul, since we got you on the line, current WBAI reporter, what is the situation at Columbia? What's going on now?
Right.
Yeah.
So this, also at NYU, students at Columbia, there's, as there are most universities around the United States, there's always been a small, dedicated group of folks working for Palestinian rights and for helping the Palestinian people. It's usually unheralded, and people suffer slings and arrows from the administration and don't get any money. So they tended to be quiet. And boom, all of a sudden, police are on campus pulling down a tent city, arresting 108 people and causing this confrontation to sort of explode on the campus with threats of culminating in threats of bringing in the National Guard from members of Congress, the mayor denouncing the demonstrators in the most vicious terms, sending the police out, upset that he's not allowed to send the police on campus until they ask him to. He just wants to send them up there. I mean, this is stuff I haven't heard for a while, and it sort of came out of nowhere. And I imagine it was building for a while. And then it sort of culminated with this situation where 108 students are arrested on Columbia campus. They refuse to go. They immediately rebuild their tent city, about 80 tents there, and are standing up for their rights. And what happens, lo and behold, yesterday, Mike Johnson, the congressman who's the Speaker of the House, arrives with all these right-wing politicians. And among the politicians are members of the House Committee on Education, which has been sort of like the new UAC, the new House Un-American Activities Committee, in a sense, that's been tasked itself rooting out anti-Semitism in these college movements. And despite the fact that these are extremely right-wing politicians, and some of them are renowned anti-Semitic people who actually run for office. I don't care what people believe in their own home, but have actually run for office on anti-Semitic platforms and gotten votes on it, and yet now they're great defenders of Jewish people, even though so many Jewish people were arrested protesting and are involved in the tent city. And this seems to be the big focus of anti-Semitism in the movement, from the river to the sea and things like that. And it doesn't jive with reality, right? From the very beginning, Jewish students and Palestinian students have together been protesting from the very first day in October 7th, despite all the things that have occurred. Mm-hmm. And then NYU steps up, just finishing up, NYU steps out, and they set up it's more of an urban campus, which is right on the sidewalk, but there's a few plazas, and they put about 50 or 100 tents on a plaza along a street in Greenwich Village, and the police come at, like, in huge, like, gangbusters. I mean, I haven't seen it. Occupy Wall Street was sort of like that. I mean, they brought in, like, 150 cops in full riot gear. They arrest 120 students and faculty. And they, it's all night. It's one of those night operations, scary night police operations that arrest. It, to me, looking back on all of this this week, which has been a very intense week in my life, when I see pictures of what, the Russians, when people try and protest Ukraine, the war in Ukraine and Russia in St. Petersburg or Moscow, and you see the cops come and they beat up people and arrest them right away. My friend, who's a Japanese journalist, has been all over the world, and he said in the United States it's no different. When it's, they might be more liberal in other things, but when it comes to stuff like this, they're the same as Russia. He's been in both places. He doesn't see any difference at all.
Right, right.
Handle protests when it's like this. And then just finally, Trump is behind this. Trump is on trial in New York, and he's angry. he's in New York, his show is in New York, and it's causing this. And I think they didn't realize this was spread across the whole nation now that there's dozens of colleges doing this, and there's fighting in Texas. And it's all these, and all these people who've been coming out are Trumpians. And last night I was listening to the biggest drunken clown on the face of the earth is America's mayor, Rudy Giuliani, a drunken fascist fool, if there ever was one. And he's with Mike Lindell from the Pillow, My Pillow guy.
Yeah.
And he's at a restaurant, an Italian restaurant in Staten Island, which is like the police borough, you know, where all the cops live. And he is chortling on his podcast about this, and I realized why this guy is behind it all. These people are behind this whole thing. This is a Trumpian thing.
Wow. Wait, what's
that's,
a what's
yeah, that's
they're
what
behind
I think,
what?
That's what I've come to believe.
They're behind what?
In New York. And it's
wait, what
it's
are they behind?
Stirring up all this trouble, you know, going into the campus out of nowhere when there was just peaceful protests going on and nothing was happening. This is the Trump show because he's on trial in New York.
Wow. That's interesting a take on all these developments. I want to get to Jennifer now for a minute. Jennifer, thank you for being patient. You heard all of that, and I know that you've been watching all the current campus unrest here in the United States, and it's leading to a pretty interesting situation where a lot of students are like, we don't even care about graduating. We got students who are being expelled from their schools and college campuses. But Jennifer, can we talk a little bit about recent developments actually in Palestine, in the occupied territories, and especially in Gaza? Recently, it was discovered that there were mass graves around some of the hospitals there. Can you talk about the situation in Gaza right now, Jennifer?
Yeah, well, I was just going to make one quick comment about the protests, which is that I think the more police that come out and try to put a stop to the protests and the more people that are who are arrested, I mean, this is just going to strengthen the protests. It already has, and it's no surprise. I don't see it as any kind of conspiracy by the police, but yeah, I mean, I think it's terrific that all these encampments are springing up. I think it's fantastic. I personally am very happy to see this taking place because, you know, if nothing else, it's a slap in the face to the Biden administration. People are saying, no, we're not accepting what you're telling us. What's happening in Gaza and in Palestine generally is terrible, and we don't like it. We're not going to just be silent and go to our classes. So in that sense, I'm actually quite pleased with it, although I'm sorry about the police presence. I think that's completely unnecessary. Mm-hmm. As for what's going on in Gaza, you know, I woke up this morning and put on Al Jazeera English, which is the news station I rely on because the mainstream here is so terrible. And, you know, news coming out of Gaza by the Nasser Hospital complex, where they've now found close to 400 bodies, is extremely disturbing. I mean, we're talking about the bodies of women, children, older people, people who were clearly sick and in the hospital. These bodies have been found with zip ties around their arms, with bullet holes in their heads, I mean, suggesting summary execution. You know, some of them, and this was creepy to me. Some of them apparently did have organs taken. And, you know, usually when I hear stories like that, my first thought is, you know, that's nonsense and this is just, you know, adding to the rumor mill. I don't think this is. When a forensic doctor gets on Al Jazeera and says that some of the bodies had their stomachs cut open and organs were missing and then the stomachs were then sort of stapled back together, that is extremely disturbing news. I just found myself sitting there listening to this thinking, you know, and how, you know, 18 countries, 18 nations have now called for an independent investigation. It's going to hinge once again on the United States. If the United States doesn't also demand an independent investigation, the chances of us getting one are very slim. but it certainly calls for it. And this is, without doubt, a crime against humanity.
Okay. Yeah, we've heard all those reports. Now, one thing I want to kind of throw out to both of you guys is this. I'm seeing some similarities to a situation during the Vietnam War in 1968, as a matter of fact. A very, I guess we could say, a crucial election time also. The anti-war movement was heating up. The Democratic Convention was in Chicago, which it's going to be this year. Is this Gaza thing? Now, and this might tie a little bit into what you're talking about, Paul, in terms of the Trumpian people behind the police. What shall I say?
If assault it smells like Trump, it looks like Trump, it must be Trump.
How is this, the war in Gaza now, how is this playing into a Trump victory? I mean, do you know what I mean? I mean, this is
yes. I want to jump in on that for a minute, because you're absolutely right, Tony. I mean, and what I noticed to me when I watch on Congress is, you know, these presidents have been fired. Two have been fired, University of Pennsylvania and Harvard, including first black president of Harvard, who's fired because over this, forced to resign. And then they're trying to force the president of Columbia to resign, right, on all of this. So to see that committee, the House Committee on Education, and I listened to that whole committee, and when you listen to it, it was mind-boggling to see a religious fanatic, right-wing, evangelical guy from Texas saying the Old Testament says that if you, I cannot believe what I'm hearing. The Old Testament says that if you are against the Jews, if you are against Israel, you are cursing, you will be cursed by God. And then he says, and then that is confirmed in the New Testament, he goes. And then he goes to the president of Harvard, the representative of the Enlightenment, the top Ivy League school in America, right? The Enlightenment, University of Wisconsin, representative of the Enlightenment of European culture, and she's like bowing down to this guy, you know, this fanatical religious. Are we going back to the medieval days? I mean, it's the strangest thing when you look at it. And these people are the religious right are a powerful force in this country, and this is a move on their part, I believe, to shore up their political position prior to this election.
All right, Jennifer, kind of on the same thing. I mean, is the Biden administration blowing it in terms of their policy on what's going on in Palestine, occupied territories?
I hope so. I mean, I think Biden has shown his colors, so to speak, since the very beginning. His policy with Israel has been, there's no daylight between the United States and Israel, certainly not when at the same time a mass grave is found, we approve $14 billion more, or $26 billion, I believe, dollars to Israel in military aid. I can certainly understand why students across the country and other people. I mean, this is not just the young, despite what Jeff Bezos wants to think. This isn't about just young and old. You know, there are many people of our generation, and there are Arab Americans and other minority groups in the United States who are absolutely appalled by what's coming out in the news, including on some of the mainstream channels, to my shock. Mm-hmm. I think the damage control that the Biden administration is going to have to do is enormous. And I have to say, I don't know what on earth is in his head or in the heads of the people who are planning his election campaign. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, people aren't just going to forget about this. They're not just going to say, oh, well, he's, you know, pro-choice, so let's vote him in. I think the outrage is very strong. I think the disaffection among the population right now is very strong. And, you know, I don't want to see Trump get elected. I think he's a terrible human being. I think he is qualitatively worse than Biden on certain issues. But I don't know what Biden is going to do to try to stop this, you know, this bleed, so to speak, from
Jennifer,
his own campaign.
Jennifer, thank you so much. And with that, we only got about 15 seconds here. So thank Jennifer Lowenstein again. Thank you very much, Middle East lecturer, for speaking on this. And also Paul DiRienzo, current WBAI reporter again.
So 2 days, they hired me back 2 days before it started again. Okay. Before this started.
Wow. All right.
It's weird.
Good.
Thank you very much.
I think it's the University of Wisconsin rubbing off. I'm so glad I went there and not to these Ivy League places where they're very toxic environments.
Yeah.
All right. Well, guys, thank you very much for being on the show this morning.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. Take care. All right, I want to thank Jim Wills. Eli, thank your dad, man. That was very cool.
He said he had a good time.
Good. And I also want to thank Greg Willard. Go check out his artwork at the Arts and Literature Lab. Stay tuned for Hajira. And, yes, it's 9 o'clock. This is WRT 89.9 FM in Madison, Wisconsin. Say that again.
Good show, Tony.
Thanks. Also, Essie Dinur. Looks like she's going to be doing Hajira today.
All right.
Stay tuned.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Thursday, April 25.
Here's how the voting system works, or doesn't. I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. In November 2026, Crystal Mason, thinking she was doing her civic duty, went to the polls to cast her vote. But her name was not on the voting roll, so Ms. Mason did what typically happens. She cast a provisional ballot. It turns out that Ms. Mason was not eligible to cast a real ballot because she was on federal supervised release. That's not a voting disqualification in many states, but it is in Texas, where she and her three children lived. Everyone agrees Ms. Mason didn't know that. But Texas prosecutors didn't care at all. They maintained lack of criminal intent was irrelevant. All that matters was that she illegally cast a provisional ballot. And she was convicted of voter fraud.